But if you were to count those lots as unsold, it would have been 74%. So, of course, it makes a lot of sense for the auction house to do it because the optics are so much better.
I'm Naomi Ray, and this is The Art Angle, a podcast from ArtNet News where the art world meets the real world, bringing each week's biggest story down to earth. Many of you are familiar with the Intelligence Report, which we introduced back in 2018 as a fusion of ArtNet's unparalleled market data and the exceptional abilities of our market journalists. By now, you've likely had a chance to review the report. So let's dive right in and talk about it. A few years back, electrifying bidding wars and monumental transactions routinely had us all on the edge of our seats in the auction room. But this sort of in-room excitement now feels a long way off, although you wouldn't necessarily know it from the triumphant post-sale press releases that are just as routinely put out by the auction houses, who are keen to signal confidence in the market and, of course, in their performance. But in 2023, there's no denying that the art market finally came back down to earth. It took a breather for a combination of reasons, including rising interest rates, geopolitical uncertainty, and let's not forget the crypto crash. But I'm not here to wax poetic about the state of the art market, because the Intelligence Report is all about data, and we have the numbers to back it up. Allow me to refresh you with some top-line figures. The average price of a fine artwork sold at auction last year dropped almost 16% from 2022. Total fine art sales generated by the big three auction houses, that's Sotheby's, Christie's, and Phillips, dropped 23% year over year. And the total spent on fine art at auction in 2023 is down 12.7%. I'm immensely proud to introduce the next two speakers who are esteemed experts in the market, and they're here to pull back the curtain on the findings of the latest report. First, we have Katia Kazakina, a face familiar to many of you. Katia's sharp investigative skills have established her as a leading voice in art market journalism. She joined ArtNet News in 2021, and her weekly Art Detective column is a signature offering of ArtNet Pro. We've actually been celebrating in the news team recently, as Katia's incredible story for the last report, the cover story for the last report actually, The Fight Against Flippers, just landed her a 2023 National Arts and Entertainment Journalism Award from the Los Angeles Press Club. Her cover story this time around is just as fascinating. It delves into the Oscar-worthy performances of the auction houses that I was alluding to just moments ago. To the casual observer, it's not that obvious how the auction houses stage manage carefully their proceedings and sometimes even the results. The practice has become all the more insidious following the repeal of a set of laws governing the auction houses in New York City. Now let's welcome our other guest, Margaret Carrigan. Margaret is another sharp market mind and the editor who is responsible for our insightful ArtNet Pro newsletter, The Back Room. Margaret has her finger on the pulse of the art market, and she'll be chatting with Katia about the report.
Thanks, everyone, for joining as well. It's really exciting to be able to have a live conversation about this. I'm obviously here with Katia Kazakina, renowned art market journalist and ArtNet's own art detective, who is going to walk us through some of the key insights of her lead report this year. There's already a lot to unpack. Auction sales were down across the board. There was a 40% decline in revenue generated by even the highest end artworks at auction last year. And of course, the average price of an artwork that sold last year was down 16%, as Naomi noted. The average sell-through rate, however, at art auctions was actually pretty high, we noticed, 71%. That's the third highest rate in a decade. So it feels like something isn't quite adding up. Prices and overall revenue reflect a substantial dip. Nevertheless, that average sell-through rate is chugging along like there is nothing to see here. So, Katia, I'm going to put some questions to you about the state of play and get to the bottom of this discrepancy between this real and perceived demand. So, Katia, you've really looked into this about how the auction houses are becoming increasingly performative in their sales. And you even called it the greatest show on earth, the title of your lead article. So this is a trend you even noticed starting last year, I think. I wonder if you can, to kind of borrow the theatrics, set the stage for us a little bit and tell us what you've been noticing in the sale rooms and beyond that's making these events more of a spectacle than they used to be.
Thank you, Maggie. And just before I start, just want to say welcome to all of our members who are here and thanks a lot for joining us. So this topic, the greatest show on earth, obviously auctions are great theater. And so in a way, what we're seeing now is just an amplification. And it's also like a result of the real life events, but also kind of like the impact of our kind of post-pandemic situation. So first of all, we've noticed since like 4 years ago when the auctions all went into live stream kind of a mode, and they really became performances with full on like TV makeup, with cameras zooming here and there onto one specialist and another. And that was the only way we could observe them, right, and participate. Then they started, instead of going from just like a sales room with a certain like hundreds of people, they became these really highly, widely broadcast events, internationally broadcast. Hundreds of thousands of people tune in to watch them. When we returned into the sales rooms after the restrictions were lifted, we noticed it was often a very sparsely attended room still because of the virus. But also we noticed that there was all this heavy equipment worthy of a media company like ABC News. Like it really feels that way a little bit. And so there was this really like sort of oddly intense theatrical element that was very new. And that was what we saw, you know, as market participants, as journalists. And that is very glamorous, very visible situation. What we're talking about in the report is something that's very geeky and very fine print. I really struggled as I worked on the story about how to make it actually readable because, you know, it can get very dry. And what we're talking about is like really fine print things, which, however, can really make a huge difference in market transparency. And they really show us also how money is made and how money is lost. And so these things that are really behind the scenes are very, very important to the business. And that's kind of how we decided to structure this story about what you see on the stage and what's going on behind the stage. So one of the things that really impacted what's happening behind the stage is that the auction houses have been governed by a set of laws. Just to make sure, we're just talking about New York. New York is the biggest auction market in the world, so we're focusing just on that. So there were regulations. Auction houses needed to be licensed. Auctioneers couldn't take chandelier bids past the secret reserve level that was agreed upon between the seller and the auction house, and multiple other things. Well, a lot of these regulations that have been in place since the 80s, actually, some of them lapsed and haven't been renewed, and some of them just were taken out. It seems to have surprised the auction people as well, as much as everyone else, but it was lumped within this more like post-pandemic rules for various industries. And so all of a sudden, everybody's got a little bit spooked about like, is it going to be a wild, wild west now? Like auction houses can do whatever they want, disclose whatever they want, not disclose what they don't want. And so I tried to understand a little bit in my reporting about what is happening in four different segments.
One of those segments that you pointed out that I thought was really interesting that you noticed a shift in, if we can start there, is the use of withdrawals in auctions. And how that kind of shifted with the repeal of those regulations. So I'm just wondering if you can talk us through about how withdrawals work and how you noticed them change a little bit in the previous couple of years.
Sure. So again, withdrawals, it's not like it happened last year. Withdrawals always happen, but it's always like, I remember it's just a big deal. Like if a major lot from an auction is withdrawn right before the sale, after being published in the catalog, after being promoted all over the world, you know, usually it's like, oh my God, what's going on? What's going on is usually that there is no interest in the lot. And instead of having it publicly fail to sell and get burned, the auction house and the seller agree to just withdraw the lot before it comes up. But in the past, I would say 2 years, I started noticing that these kinds of withdrawals are now happening like in greater numbers. And also in the past year, like as the sale begins, they happen like almost up to the lot. And so sometimes they're announced, sometimes they're not announced, and they just announced right before. And it just creates this confusion in the sales room. And one of the things that I wrote about in the article was that last May, Sotheby's, their cover lot of their Now sale, which is like ultra contemporary art, had this Nara painting that was estimated at $12 to $18 million, and it was withdrawn last minute. And that one lot represented a third of the auction's estimate. So these kinds of withdrawals are very significant. You know, and that also just varies by the house. And Sotheby's, I would say, really has been using this strategy most aggressively. In November, Sotheby's withdrew 8 lots that were like jointly estimated almost $20 million from their modern art evening sale. At the end of the sale, they reported 94% sell-through rate, is what you alluded to before, Maggie. But if you were to count those lots as unsold, it would have been 74%. So, of course, it makes a lot of sense for the auction house to do it because the optics are so much better. You can report 94% sell-through rate as opposed to 74% sell-through rate. And the sell-through rate is one of those things that the auction houses use to gain clients, because their clients want their works to sell, obviously. And so they say, oh, gee, like we had a 74% sell-through rate in the previous lot. They will look terrible, right? But if they say 94%, no problem. So that has been like a really convenient tool. Christie's told me that their withdrawal rate is fairly steady and rather minimal, like 4% overall. In the last few years, Sotheby's didn't give me their numbers, but we have been tracking them. And Sotheby's, by the way, it has had like a lot of these wide glove sales where 100% of works are sold. And it's, again, very dramatic, glamorous, theatrical gesture that at the end of the sale, an auctioneer is given this set of white gloves that represent 100% sell-through rate. They're not very common, those sales, but I noticed that they become more and more common. And of course, it just depends how you look at it, right? Because if you withdraw 2 lots or 6 lots before the sale and then say that everything else sold, then, you know, it kind of makes you wonder.
Yeah, definitely. So the withdrawals are solving for the problem of if there's no interest in a particular work and sort of scrubbing that potential black mark from the record. But when there is interest in a work, certainly we should be able to tell by the flurry of bids in the room, right? Or has that changed as well?
So that's another interesting point. In the past, for many years, and until the regulations have just been changed, auctioneers had to bid up to this undisclosed reserve, and they announced this in the sales room. And if an auctioneer reaches the reserve and there are no takers, the work passes. But up to that point, an auctioneer is allowed to use what's known as chandelier bids. So it's basically like bids that takes off the chandelier, just made up bids. They don't exist. Those bids are not real. Gentleman in the back, lady right here, you know, are you bidding Alex? Are you bidding Brooke? You know, it's a play. It's pure theater. And those experts and people who go to the auction houses, buyers, sellers, traders, dealers, they all know. And there's a way to tell whether they're real bids or not, but sometimes it's very tricky. The telltale sign of whether it's a real bid is when the auctioneer says, I can sell it. And then those 4 words, I can sell it, indicate to the audience that a reserve has been reached and now this work can actually be sold. But some very experienced auctioneers make it very difficult to really tell whether those bids are chandelier bids or real bids. However, they have to stop at the point of the reserve and then nothing. Well, now there's no such rule anymore. So auction houses told me that they're not going to proceed in the same way they always have. But when you're dealing with the guarantees and the third-party guarantees on the works, those guarantees are effectively become a new reserve, you follow what I'm saying? So It's a new minimum level at which a work is allowed to sell. And now what I heard and what people in the industry understand to be happening, even though the auction houses have been denying this, but people who are bidding, who are consigning works, understand that this may be happening, is that instead of one person being one bid, sometimes what they do now is that they would split, or they can at least split one bid into multiple people. It's a little bit confusing. I'm going to try to explain this. But let's say if you have a guarantee at, let's say, $100 million, right, for a Picasso, a third party guarantee. So somebody says that I will buy this work, I will raise my paddle at this level. So what they can do now is break up that guarantee into two or three, however many people have it be executed by you, Maggie, and Naomi, and me. So you will bid 90, I will bid 95, and Naomi will bid 100. But there will be still one bid. But there's nothing illegal about them doing this right now. So why this is good? Because Naomi, maybe not Naomi, but maybe it could be Kathy from Hong Kong, or I could be Katya from, I don't know, Russia. not anymore. But I'm just saying that you could create, again, the optics of incredibly buoyant market, geographically buoyant, or just like by a number of people, whereas ultimately you only have one bid.
Right. So just to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. So essentially the specialists that are in the room, they might be on the phone or they might be representing someone, and they're bidding against each other up to that amount.
Right.
But it's just still the same one client who's...
Right. They're executing one third party guarantee, right?
Yeah.
It's not illegal. Like, they can do it. They say they don't do it.
Sure. I think that's really interesting too, because you touched on guarantees. Obviously, those have been such a hot topic in the art market for the last several years. Something that I think is interesting about the guarantees is they're predetermined financial arrangements. So they've been orchestrating the flow of the auction houses for a while, and now they're kind of leveraging them even further into the kind of smoke and mirrors theatrics of these sales. Do auction houses even have to report those guarantees? How are they reporting those guarantees? Is it easy to figure out what's guaranteed and what's not?
First of all, yes, they had to report and mark very clearly in catalogs online what lots are guaranteed, what lots have irrevocable bid attached to them. Now they don't have to. Again, the auction houses say that they will continue with this practice, but they don't have to. And so what it means is they can put up that sign now or later or whenever they want. The point is that it's all in flux, right? And things are changing. And that was another part that I want to make, is that right now it's a little bit chaotic. Before, auction houses, they kind of move in tandem. One raises fees, another raises fees, or they change something and that does follow. But right now, everybody in the last, I would say, 2-3 seasons or even 4 have been doing something slightly different. And so just the way they disclose, for example, guarantees, like Christie's continues to do the way they always have done it. Before the sale, they announce everything that's been withdrawn, everything that has additional guarantees, IBs, etc. Sotheby's suddenly stopped doing that. So now they say, okay, we refer you to the catalog, and then you're on your own. And Phillips announces some, doesn't announce others, but they're all doing it differently. I noticed also that in March in London, Sotheby's went back to announcing all of this stuff before the sale, after the publication of our article. So it's kind of like a little chaotic.
Interesting. So before we go to the audience questions, just one last lingering question from my end is, considering that the regulatory shifts have contributed to more of this performativity, do you think that the rise of the showbiz style auction was to an extent inevitable considering these changes? Or has the adoption of these techniques been more catalyzed by the softer market of the last year? And do you think that that'll kind of reshape the auction trade going forward? Is there any coming back from this?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens. again, like I said before, every auction house told me that they haven't really done much different things since these rules went out, except I would say for reporting final prices. And this, I just want to mention Christie's before, for many, many years until 2016, if you had a guaranteed sale, right, they reported them hammer plus buyer's premium. That was it. In 2016, auction houses were asked to report prices net of fees that they paid their backers of these lots. And sometimes we're talking about millions of dollars on certain works. There was a Basquiat piece in November that sold for over $40 million, and the fee was $3 million the guarantor got for backing up this work. In some cases, we're talking about substantial amounts of money. And so from 2016 until just a year ago, auctioneers had to report whenever they paid the guarantor, they had to calculate every single lot, go back, hammer plus buyer's premium minus whatever was paid to that person. Well, now they don't have to do it anymore. And so now Christie's and Phillips went back to just doing hammer and buyer's premium, but Sotheby's continues subtracting that fee from the final sale. So basically what result could be very confusing, where two works could hammer for exactly the same amount, even at the same house. But because one lot was under this guarantees arrangement and was bought by the guarantor who received a fee, the final price would be lower than the other buyer who did not have a fee. And so it just gets really, really technical. So you just have to watch out, look at every single lot, and be very careful about how you read the statistics.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to actually use that as the perfect transition to our first question from the audience. This is an exclusive opportunity for our members to ask questions live. Our first one comes from Elena, and she asks, do you think the change in the Sotheby's fee structure that you mentioned was directly affected by the Rybolovlev fraud accusations that we saw play out in the New York federal courts recently earlier this year? And that was a really big moment for casting auction house transparency into the limelight. So do you think they're related?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that was an epic trial, but I don't think it really had to do with that. At least that's not how I read it or understood it. I think basically the competition right now, especially like the market conditions are not great. And so the focus on consignment is even more intense than usually, right? Because they're all fighting for the same works. And so a lot of times to win these works, they have to give away sometimes all upside through guaranteeing to the seller and then paying to the buyer, maybe to the IBer. And so for some of these top collections and top consignments, they are lucky to make some money. And so I think that that fee structure really represents their attempt to make money somewhere. They're just giving away a lot of money.
Interesting. I can see where you're coming from. It certainly did seem related, the cadence of them. You know, the trial ended and then Sotheby's announced that they'd be changing their fee structure. It was a moment to be like, but I definitely see what you're saying, that there is something larger at play there in terms of just how the sales are structured.
Yeah, they're just trying to make money, I think.
We have another question for you. Can you talk a little bit more about how the financial fees guarantors receive are then reported by Sotheby's in the final reported price? Were the other auction houses doing this up until the law was repealed? And they said they're thinking about this from an appraiser's perspective and how one might think about fair market value.
So that's exactly the point. That's why I think it's so murky and potentially problematic, exactly because of these appraisals or fair market value. You're exactly right. So Sotheby's reports their prices the same way as it has since 2016. It's hammer price plus BP minus a fee that was paid to the guarantor. Christie's and Phillips don't do it anymore. They just do hammer price plus BP. So it's very difficult to compare values. And I even wrote a whole story about this after November sales, in fact, because there were two lots in the same auction, one by Jenny Saville, one by Julie Meritu. And I was covering the sale, and I remember that they hammered very closely, but one was less than the other. And whichever was less ended up being, in the final price, worth more than the one that hammered for more. Because the one that hammered for more included that subtracted fee to the guarantor. I'm sorry, it's so technical. I hate it.
I feel like I need to be like doing some algebra as you're writing this down so I can just see the numbers.
I suffered for this article. You cannot imagine. But yeah, so that's an issue.
Yeah, definitely.
We look a lot more, I think, right now as journalists at hammer prices and hammer totals for the auctions. And what we're trying to do is compare hammer total to the estimate for the sale, for example, that don't include bias premium, to the hammer total for the sale. And that gives us the clearest indication of performance. And you can request, I think, hammer prices from the auction houses, or you could read our articles.
Exactly. I was going to say, they don't publish those themselves, but ArtNet does.
So you could follow our coverage, and we're here for you.
We have a question from Joan. She emailed us ahead of time, actually. She says, there's been a lot of dumping works into auction last year and early this year to get rid of works by emerging artists that are not performing as well as expected. Do you expect this to continue?
Definitely.
An easy one.
Not a question. Absolutely. Because of what I hear from my sources, people just want to get out of stuff, as they say. Which is really painful to hear, to be honest, because we at ArtNet love art. It's very sobering because on the way up, everybody, of course, talks about the value of art and how important they are. And on the way down, everybody talks about it like product and stuff. And it's just pretty awful. But it is an investment. I would say this, and maybe just in hindsight, remembering I covered very closely the 10 years ago, the rise and fall of zombie formalism. And I'm pretty sure that this is what's going to happen as well now, is that people will try to dump works by emerging artists at auction, but they might not be able to. Because I think at one point, when auction houses see that trend, they just won't take the works.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I don't really know exactly what they take, what they don't take, but they will not take indefinite number of works by artists they know are going to tank.
Mm-hmm.
So what will happen is that these artists will kind of just vanish and like quietly disappear from the sales for a number of years, and then they will reappear at values that are pre-skyrocketing.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, like you can see the works by a lot of these zombie formalists who went into hundreds of thousands of dollars, now trading at 10 to 12, 10 to 15, sort of where they started from. And I think that this is going to be similar now. But at the same time, adding to this market complexity, I feel like there is such a churn, something we've written about as well. There's such a churn in the market, and people are really hungry to discover young artists and to capitalize on their rising values. And that first arbitrage where prices go from, I don't know, 5 to like 50, or from 10 to 100, or from 20 to a million. I don't know, like we've seen it all. It's all happened. But I think that auction houses are still finding new names. We're just working on our next piece, actually looking at auction, you should not miss it, but kind of looking at London sales of 2 weeks ago through this prism. And there are a whole bunch of names by artists who've overperformed compared to their estimates in quite stellar ways. So there's going to be more, and there's going to be a lot less.
Mm. So they say emerging artists will continue to blow up, but then it'll just be a constant cycle of who's blowing up and who's not.
Right.
Got it.
It might be just hard to resell things.
Right.
For astronomical prices.
Yeah. We have another question that Morgan reached out to us ahead of time as well. And they ask, the fine art print market was a fabulous source of creativity and revenue for artists, dealers, and publishers in the 1970s and 80s. What's happening with that now? And is there a new awakening amongst artists and collectors for prints?
Yes. You know, prints are a great starting point for collectors. Like traditionally, it always has been a way into collecting and into connoisseurship. And I think it remains the same. I think a lot of artists love working with multiples. Just to give you an example of how it could work right now, it may be not so recent, but it's fairly recent. Place Prints. They work with a lot of very, very hot contemporary artists always, and they collaborate with them. They find master printers that the artists collaborate with to create a body of prints. To give you one example, it was like Art Basel, I'm forgetting, maybe 2018, maybe 2017, when Kors blew up at auction in November. And it was all anyone was talking about. And I entered the convention center in Miami, like the first moment. And someone told me, Katya, you have to go and see. There's a huge line of people outside of this booth. And so, of course, I ran there. And there was a huge line of people at like 11:10. And the entrance was at 11 in the morning. And so there was a very large triptych of prints by Kors that was being offered by Pace Prints. I don't remember edition, but it was a substantial edition, maybe 60, something like that. And the price was also substantial, but not as substantial as his paintings were selling for at auction. And so people were just like trying to snap them up and everything sold out. They had this huge waiting list. They had to decide who gets what, when, whatever, but it was gone like in a second. And so there are multiple examples of their other amazing artists that do prints.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that prints are kind of having an interesting moment. I mean, Pace obviously launched their Pace Prints, and then Hausenworth and David's Werner also have print divisions now. I think there's a real interest in it. And something too, I think we noticed in the intelligence report was that even if higher value works weren't selling as well at auction, lower value works were. So again, to your point, like I think in terms of where we're at overall in the market, there is still an appetite for lower price works, and those are still moving through the auction houses a little bit as well.
The beauty, of course, of prints is that you can get a work by a significant artist at a much lower price. And it's a fantastic proposition.
Yep. Another question for you that's just come in. Going back to some of the repealed guidelines that you mentioned earlier, even though those were repealed in New York, are there similar laws in place elsewhere in the world, like in the UK or the EU? Because you mentioned that Sotheby's still announced all of the withdrawals from the top of the London auction. So are things changing elsewhere? Or are there more regulations that would influence the sales?
That's a really good question. And I don't know the answer. We'll look into it.
Definitely. Yeah. Our next big investigation.
No. I wondered why they did it. And I'm not sure whether they announced it this way because of the different regulatory environment in the UK, but I'll follow up.
Perfect. We look forward to that. Another one has just popped up. The report talks about how auction houses craft a narrative to make the market look better than it is and their own performance. Presumably, they think it'll be good for business, but the top execs insist that they benefit from transparency in the business. So is transparency good or bad for the market?
I mean, I think transparency is good for the market, but I don't know what they think. You know, if you think about Sotheby's, as you know, Sotheby's was a publicly traded company. And so Sotheby's had to disclose a whole bunch of information on a quarterly basis and annual reports, quarterly reports, all kinds of stuff came out. I love that because I could get so much news out of it. And again, fine print, publicly available, gave a lot of information to the market that doesn't exist anymore. But I also think that to your point, to your question, Sotheby's always thought that it was, and its competitors also said that it was at a disadvantage. Mm. Because neither Christie's nor Phillips, I mean, Christie's is really the biggest competitor, had to report anything of that magnitude. So now that they're all private, the window has closed. Although again, in the UK, interestingly, companies do have to file more through regulatory. There's like a company's house, right, Maggie? You would know this better.
Yeah.
There is a little window into UK operations of the auction houses there because of that. But I feel like market wants transparency, but the art market is historically very opaque.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this eternal tension. And I think we are inching towards transparency in many ways, right? Like the know your client regulations, all the anti-money laundering regulations in the EU specifically, and then UK, you know, and US also requires a lot more before people could hide behind their trusts and behind their LLCs, and auction houses could say, well, we don't really know. Like I would find out so-and-so was selling an anonymous consignor of a major work, and the auction house would tell me, well, no, you can't report it because you don't know who that person really is. It's not him or her. It could be an entity. It could be whatever, right? They don't know. They could claim that they don't know the ultimate consigner, but right now they cannot do that. They know the ultimate consigner. So we could say, well, you know who it is. Like, I don't care through which entity he's selling it. It's this push and pull, I guess, is what's happening. But I feel like maybe we're moving towards greater transparency overall, I hope.
I think it would be welcome for most people. But like you said, I guess it would depend on who you ask. I would say as a follow-up question, which of the big three houses is the most transparent at the moment, in your opinion?
I don't know. They're not transparent. It's a difficult question. You know, it's like, I always feel like you have to check constantly because they say one thing and it's not necessarily that they want to conceal something. Sometimes they just don't know. It's also in my article, you know, in one respect, Sotheby's seems not transparent on withdrawals, for example, or how it announces things, but then it's more transparent in how it reports final prices. And Christie's, again, I was looking at guarantees, those added guarantees last minute that happened mm-hmm. right before the sale and that are announced in the sales room. If you go back in the online catalog, I was sure that they were all marked before and now they're not marked.
Mm.
Christie's was as surprised, like the person I was talking to, as I was, that they were not marked. All these little things, and it's very hard to know which one. They're all playing a little bit by their own rules right now because the main rule, a set of rule, has been revoked. Mm-hmm. So everybody's doing something a little bit different. It's hard to know who is more transparent.
Do you think to an extent they're trying out different tactics and seeing what sticks?
I think so. For my work, you know, I have to be carefully watching how they do this. I would not assume that just because they said that they haven't changed anything, they won't do it in the future.
Right. Our final question for you is that the women's position in the top 100 artists seems to be on the rise. In which categories of the market are we seeing this happening, and will we see it continue?
I mean, contemporary, I would say, more than anything else. I feel like there is a motion there and more space, perhaps, for equity. It's a little tricky, right? We're talking about equity, but it's really demand, right? You know, the auction houses also have been better. I think putting more female artists in their sales. There were a few seasons when a bunch of them, like maybe all three of them, would begin their sales of contemporary art, specifically with female, you know, Sotheby's. I remember Sotheby's did that. First 10 lots were all by female artists. And there are more female artists working today, you know, and mm-hmm. just a fact, you know. So I would say like in ultra contemporary and contemporary art, this is where we would see this dynamic play out. And of course, something I love to write about and always rooting the girls.
Yes, definitely. We love to see more of it. So we'll continue following your writing on it and celebrate with you. Thank you again, Katya, for all of your insights and for all of your work on the report. Thanks to all of our members who joined us today. It's been wonderful getting your questions in and seeing so many of you online with us. If you haven't already, read the full intelligence report online for even more intel on the market, and we'll catch you next year. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, you guys.
That's it for this week's episode. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Also, take a moment to rate and review us. It will help other listeners discover what we're doing. The Art Angle is produced by Sonia Manalili and Caroline Goldstein. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.